We went through this once, but it's just like, you know, every time I see things like that, I think to myself, at Yale, they wouldn't get it. You know, they say, oh, it's all for free. You just walk off. Because it's all in the mind of the interpreter. Interpretation is whatever you think in there.
Yeah. Excuse me. Okay.
Today I want to talk to you about something that's related to what we spoke about for the last 2 weeks, but has it's a two-edged sword. Do we have blue books here? We have a whole pile of them over there.
Oh.
One for each. It's a very small thing, but I want you to see it inside, because let's really hide the book of Jonah here. That's not with the five beginnings, that's probably with Yom Kippur. Page 1238. Maybe it's a little bit further in. Yeah. 1239. Okay, 1239. This is the book of Jonah. And there's a storm. And the people on the ship are all praying to their gods to be saved. Finally, they decide to cast lots. And the lot comes out on Jonah. So he's the one that's responsible. Verse 8, about a third of the way down the page. They, the people on the ship, said to him, Jonah, tell us now. In regard to whom? What? Man, I don't know where they're coming from. It's not a question. It's a statement. I don't know why they put a question on. Tell us now, seeing that you are the one who's responsible for this problem. You're the one responsible, because the lots came out on you. Now, I want to ask you some questions. Here are the questions. What is your trade or your work? From where do you come? What is your land? And of what people are you? So they're asking him four questions. The first question is, what is his work? And the other three are his origins. Now look what he answers. 9, he said to them, I am an Ivri, and Hashem, the God of the heavens, do I fear, who made the sea and the dry land. Now, how is his answer related to their questions? Well, listen, does he answer the first question? Not at all.
Where from he answers? Works for God.
He doesn't answer the first question at all. The second, well, where he's from? I don't know if I am an Ivri tells him where he's from. It's probably what people, right? Ivri is probably what people he chooses to call the Jewish people Ivri for whatever reason. And then he says, Hashem, the God of the heavens, do I fear? They didn't ask him that at all. So what's going on here? They ask him four questions. He answers one, and then he offers something else, which they didn't ask at all. Now, I think that this is as modern as today. Let's suppose that you are at a social gathering, and you're introduced to someone, and you have to start a conversation. What is the first thing that you ask? Okay, fine. Suppose you're introduced. Peter, meet Paul. Paul, meet Peter. Hello, how are you? Where are you from?
What do you do for a living?
And what do you do for a living? Why is what do you do for a living the first, or one of the first questions you'll always ask? What's so important about what you do for a living? Because that tells you who the person is. You get more information from answering that one question than you could get from answering any other one question. Suppose he says, I'm an accountant. If he's an accountant, he's been to college, and he's taken special courses, and he's passed certain exams, he has a certain level of intellect, he has a certain level of ability to study, he's going to be working in a certain sector, he's going to have he's going to keep company with certain kinds of people. You know an awful lot about him if he says that he's an accountant. And if he says, I'm a plumber, all those questions, all those facts are filled in a different way. He probably didn't go to college, and he probably is earning more than the accountant, and he probably, his knowledge and abilities will be around physical organization of buildings. Asking what a person's job is in our society, in their society 3,000 years ago, and at most places, ask what his job is, you learn more about him than you learn from any other one question. But there's a big exception. And the big exception is the Jewish people. Because with respect to the Jewish people, asking what a person's work is tells you next to nothing about him. You'll meet Abraham. Oh, nice to meet you, Abraham. What do you do for a living, Abraham? Well, I'm a shepherd. Ah, now I know. Aha, you're a shepherd. Well, shepherd is the lowest of the low. It's dreadfully unskilled labor. You take people with no education and no talents to be the, they are coarse, low, mean lot of people. So now I know. He's a shepherd. Then it clearly, now I know. I can classify Abraham and I can categorize him and I've gotten information about him. You know nothing about Abraham. Nothing. To find out that he's a shepherd. Rabbi Yochanan. Oh, Yochanan. Nice to meet you. What do you do for a living? I'm a shoemaker. Can you imagine a Jewish mother today who could say with pride, oh, what happened to my son, my little Jimmy? He became a shoemaker. She would never reveal that in public. He's in the manufacturer of clothing. He's a clothing manufacturer. I'm sitting there with a hammer and nails and banging nails and shoes. He's manufacturing clothing. Couldn't be a shoemaker. Now, what will you learn about Rabbi Yochanan to find out that he's a shoemaker? And indeed, what will you learn about Rabbi Eliezer when you find out that he's an international business tycoon, that he has ships on all the seas? He's a very successful merchant. Oh, he's a very successful merchant with international trade. I can just imagine him negotiating international contracts and making multi-year investments and buying and selling and researching. Oh, now I've got it. Now I've got Rebbe Eliezer. Baloney. You definitely don't have Rebbe Eliezer. Hillel, the beginning of his career, was a woodchopper. You could go into competition with the shepherds if you're a woodchopper. Who's the lowest? Who's the least skilled, the least paid, the least respected possible worker? So say, oh, Hillel, woodchopper. Okay, put him in the category. Now I know. You don't know anything about Hillel. Nothing. You don't even know why he's chopping wood. The person's job, Rashi. Rashi was a winemaker and wine merchant. Hardly anybody knows that. What they know is that he was one of the greatest scholars of all Jewish history. That is, every word is, there isn't a moment in the day when there aren't thousands of people who are saying, Rashi says this and Rashi says that. What did Rashi say and what did Rashi mean? 900 years after his time. He told his wine merchant, you don't know anything about Rashi. For us, the job, the work, does not tell who the person is. So Yonah identifies himself. Number one, I'm an Ivri. I'm a Jew. I belong to that special people. And I serve the Creator of heavens and earth. That's who I am. Not who I am, that's who I am. That's my identity. I might happen to work at one thing or another to make a living. Almost everybody has to work at something to make a living. Good. But that's as as important to understanding my identity as my clothes. It's just something I do. It's not who I am. Yeah.
Why is it in modern times, especially in Jewish circles, I'm either be a doctor or a lawyer or some, like, I find that more soon in the Jewish community than outside the Jewish community, that perception.
Okay. I don't know why more so, but I can just tell you that this in general is a non-Jewish value which we have absorbed. So much so that non-Jewish value can deeply corrupt a person's identity. Viktor Frankl, who was a psychiatrist, psychotherapist, and he invented this whole school of psychotherapy called logotherapy or existential therapy, lived through the Holocaust. He writes in one of his books, he was a psychiatrist before the war, and he's put into a work camp with all the other Jews, and he writes at a certain point that apparently he wasn't working fast enough for the Nazi guard to be satisfied with him, so the Nazi guard picked up a clod of earth and threw it at him. And he said to himself, I found that so degrading. Here, if it weren't wartime, he could have been a patient in my hospital. You know, a psychiatrist is an MD, plus having a psychology degree. He could have been a patient in my hospital. I would have been the respected professor, and he would be someone to whom I could give important services. Here he throws a clod of earth at me. That's not the way you treat a human being, it's the way you treat an animal. So he's overwhelmed by the irony of the situation that he, who has such professional credentials, he's a psychiatrist, the top of the medical scientific educated classes, is being treated like an animal. No. From my point of view, the answer would be, so what? So you have a degree, so what? You could have all the degrees in the world and still deserve to be treated like an animal. That's not the difference between you and an animal, that you have degrees. This wounded him because it came from the very same culture that taught him to respect the degrees. The German culture taught him to respect the degrees, and now, vis-a-vis Germans, his degrees don't mean anything. So he's undone. His whole basis for an identity is undone. A Jew who had authentic Jewish credentials, authentic Jewish identity, this wouldn't bother him at all. What he would say is, this lout that's throwing the clod of earth himself is no better than a cow. Would you feel it wounding your dignity if a cow stepped on your foot? Dignity? It's a cow stepping on your foot. Well, what do you need dignity from a cow? You don't have respect from a cow. Might hurt, but doesn't wound your dignity. No, but here it comes from the culture that gave him his dignity. And now they're not recognizing it. So he's stripped of it. Here, Jung is teaching us, 3,000 years before, I'm sure Viktor Frankl didn't read Jung, he's teaching us that you don't take your identity, your respect, your dignity, your honor from your profession. That's not where it comes from. There's no reason why, if a person, Gemara says that if a person doesn't have any other way to earn his living, he should earn his living cleaning up the shuk. He should not take charity if he has any way to earn a living. It makes no absolute difference. It makes no difference whether he's a rabbi or is anybody else. The work you do does not determine what kind of person you are, what your identity is. Now, sorry? What he said, that I'm a Jew and I serve God. That determines my identity. That's what I am. That's who I am. The other things are things I do. But they're not what I am or who I am. Now, some people, going back now to women's and men's roles, complain that if the woman's role, not by law, but by custom, by value, by respect, is to be a homemaker, then she is deprived of her opportunity to have a successful profession. Not absolutely deprived. There are women who manage both, or there are women who, after the children are raised and grown, do go out and have professions. But to be really tops, you can't start when you're 45. You have to start when you're in your early 20s, and you have to push, and you have to be putting in 50, 60-hour weeks, for 50 weeks a year, for 5 or 10 years, and you build yourself to the top of the profession, and you can earn $250,000 a year. Women are being deprived of that opportunity. Well, this goes all the way back to the first few sessions that we had. Whether being deprived of that opportunity is discrimination, whether it's victimizing, depends upon whether that opportunity has value or not. From our point of view, the opportunity to have that kind of career is worthless. It's worthless. Because that's not our job. And a person who gets so wrapped up in his career that he comes to identify with it, it's a double tragedy. Number one, he's wasting so much time chasing money that he doesn't need, wasting his life. But worse than that, he's losing his identity. There was this story I heard third hand, but if it isn't exactly right, it's appropriate. A fellow whose father was very wealthy, he was 25 years old, he was in yeshiva, and his father said, listen, come to me and work for me for 10 years in the business. I guarantee, by the time you're 35, you'll have enough money put away that you can learn for the rest of your life. So he went to this Rosh Yeshiva and asked him, what he should do? And the Rosh Yeshiva said, your father is very smart. Your father is very smart because he knows that if you work with him in the business for 10 years, you won't want to learn for the rest of your life. You'll be a different person after working with him in the business for 10 years. So he's not giving anything away when he makes you this promise. This is what can happen to a person. You lose your goals, you lose your perspective, you lose your priorities because the work takes over your identity. Now, in that case, if a woman, by social position, is expected and is reinforced to be a homemaker, mother, spouse, and that's her main focus, she's being protected from a danger. She's not being deprived of a valuable opportunity. And men who do have the primary responsibility to support their families, men are exposed to this danger. And indeed, men are regularly sucked into this. They're sucked into it, and they lose their perspective. It's a terrible, terrible danger, the anti-Jonah syndrome, where the person measures himself. He measures himself by his profession, how much he earns, or the honor of the profession. It can happen to anybody. When I became frum, I went to graduate school and got my PhD and I started to teach. I was professor at Johns Hopkins University, a professor of logic. Could you imagine? Professor of logic. And in the town, one of the Rosh Yeshivas of Ne Yisrael used to give a weekly shiur for businessmen. For people in the community. I mean, whoever wanted to come. Not in the yeshiva, but in the community of balabatim, as they say, householders. So I decided to join the shiur. Okay, maybe I didn't have as much background as some of the other people in this year. That's a professor of logic with a PhD teaching at one of the country's good universities. Was I surprised how bright those businessmen were, how sharp they were, how much faster they got the answers to the questions than I did. It taught me something. It taught me that the fact that you're a professor doesn't mean that you have the best brains. Because you know something? People with brains, a lot of them, use it to make money. And there's big money out there, and it goes to the people who can do the best. So they use their brains to make money. So the fact that you spend a lot of time reading books doesn't mean you're smarter than everybody else. It just means you like to read books. Boy, did that teach me a lesson. the businessman out there who's managing an economic enterprise and is in competition with others, and he's successful, he's got to be pretty smart and pretty thorough and pretty clear and precise. He's got to know a lot and be able to focus it and put it to use. Otherwise, he's not going to be making all that money. He'll be outcompeted by someone else. So the prestige of the profession can attract a person, even if it isn't the money. I never envied the businessman. I was very happy being a professor. And I got prestige out of it. But still, that's not where your identity lies. Your identity lies in the fact that you're serving Kodesh Baruch Hu. So this is something which... Now, to give you an example of how this works, I'll tell you a story which... 20 minutes ago should have rubbed you the wrong way, and probably now it'll still rub you the wrong way, which means that it's still taking time for the idea to sink in. I have a friend who's a rav in Flatbush. Quite a wealthy congregation. And he's told me that a number of times, he told me this story in order to test me. A number of times women in the community would come to him and ask him for permission to have a certain profession. It's a really firm place. Because that means the women will come to the rabbi and ask. You know, most places they won't even come and ask. So he said to me, what do you think I told him? So I said, well, I know that Jewish women have worked from the beginning. I mean, what? There were many times in history where if everybody didn't work, they would starve to death. Everybody had to work. And in terms of halacha, a woman can enter into any business arrangement that a man can. And she can sign contracts and hire workers and fire workers and be hired. There's absolutely no difference between a man and a woman in work circumstances. So I said, of course, he said, they can certainly do so. And he said, nope, I told them they can't. I was surprised, so that means I failed the test. And he said, these women's husbands make lots of money. They don't lack anything. So why are they going out to work? Because they feel that if they're not working, if they don't have their name on the office door, if they don't have their own special telephone line, if they don't have their expense account, they're nothing. That's going to make them into something. And he said, that's not the way a Jew makes himself into something. And if they're going after that, it means they're running away from the real problem. The real problem is they don't have the right attitude towards Torah and towards mitzvot. Otherwise, a person gets to the end of the day and say, I went to the hospital and there was that patient there who was suffering from burns and was in terrible pain and nobody was there to help. And I was there and I was able to help and able to make the person more comfortable. Wow, what a successful day. What a wonderful, successful day. If you can't feel that, then your identity is being sucked up by something else and you're losing your essence. So I said to him, he told me that it's not appropriate to solve the problem that way. Let's work on improving your spiritual focus. That's a Jewish perspective. Now, it's true, men could use that kind of reordering as well. But somebody does have to earn the money. And here, again, you see the danger and the sacrifice that men are put into, which women are spared. Yeah.
Like you told us last week, that there's no mitzvah to work. The mitzvah is 613. So if you have like significant financial backing, if you have a lot of money, then you don't have to go to work just to fill your ego. You should be able to put your time into mitzvahs.
100%. That's 100% true. I think the perfect example of this is Bill Gates. What is he working for? So instead of $72 billion, he'll have $74 billion? What's he going to do with the extra $2 billion? What's he going to do with the first $72 billion? So the working here is not for more zeros. The working here is because if he doesn't work, he's not alive. Why is it that when so many people retire, they go into physical and mental decline, sometimes very rapidly? Because without work, they have nothing to do. They really have nothing to do. There's nothing important. They define what makes them important is that somebody else needs me. Somebody else needs me. Somebody else counts on me. If I don't make it to the office, certain projects aren't going to go through. So I'm important. So that importance focuses them. But without the work that needs them, there's nothing important in their lives. So they go and play golf. A person cannot survive on golf. most people, I won't say there aren't exceptions, but the average person cannot survive on golf. Because deep down he knows it's trivial. How long can you live a trivial existence? But if a person knows that Kodesh Baruch Hu, Balabai is dochek, Kodesh Baruch Hu is demanding that his jobs be done. And the jobs are there until the moment the person dies. So the focus is always there, the identity is always there, the reality is always there. But that requires you to detach yourself from those false identities.
It's preferable for the man to work or the woman to work, besides for the problem of raising kids, if that wouldn't be an issue.
I didn't say anything about preferable, I said the responsibility. The legal responsibility falls on the man.
Is that because women have children and they just physically can't work?
I'll explain to you the reason, but this is chazara for the others, but won't hurt them. We said that the way in which the money in a marriage works. Anybody remember this? There are two possibilities of how money can be arranged in a marriage. What are the two possibilities? Okay, I'll remind you. Either the husband has responsibility for supporting the family. It's his sole responsibility. Then, if the wife happens to earn some money, it goes to him. He has control of all the money, and he has the total responsibility. That's one possibility. The other possibility is that the husband and wife each earn whatever money they earn in their separate bank accounts, and they split the expenses. And under those conditions, the wife's earnings are her own earnings. She just has to help support the expenses of the family. So those are the two possibilities. Now, which way it works depends only on her choice. It depends only on her choice. She can say to the husband, I have a right to be supported. I don't have to support myself. You go out to work, and I'll live off what you earn. Because I don't have to produce money. You have to produce money. Or she can say, listen, you're a bus driver and I'm an architect. I'm going to earn more money than you anyhow. So you take your earnings and put them in your bank account. I'll take my earnings and put them in my bank account, but I'll split the expenses with you. And it's her choice. It's one of the ways in which women are protected in marriage. A husband cannot domineer the monetary.
From a legal point of view?
That's the halacha in the Gemara. One of those cases where it says a person can refuse a takanas chachamim that's made for their favor. A woman can refuse a takanas chachamim that her husband has to support her if she doesn't want it. Only if they have the first arrangement, not if they have the second arrangement.
So Kol Mashi Shekhan Abayl doesn't go on if there's another arrangement?
Correct. Yeah. Correct. So, when you ask whether what is preferable, that's going to vary. That's going to vary in every case. As you know, and maybe the guys don't know as well, in many cases, I would say it's almost become a norm in the Haredi world. As long as a woman can work and support her husband in learning, she will do so. Of course, there may very well come a time when she cannot support the husband anymore, and then it is his responsibility to go out to work. And as a chosid, this is a fixed principle. When the time comes, the husband has to go out to work. And if others say differently, let them justify it. But it is accepted that a woman will work as long as she can to support her husband in learning. This is not her responsibility. This is the voluntary, beautiful, self-sacrificing activity that she's, but she cannot, she is not responsible to do this. You'll say, but what kind of life is that? I mean, is it fair to her that she should have, that she's carrying essentially a double burden? Although husbands do help out. This one, a person who today is a very famous person, he was a Rosh Yeshiva for many years, and they had a lot of children, and the way the house was organized, the rule in the house was that the mother got up at 9 a.m., the husband woke the children and dressed the children and fed the children and made their lunches and sent them off to school. That was his responsibility. After that, she took over the house. But till 9 a.m., he was there. Which meant, I guess, that he died very early to be home, you know. Yeah, or very late, right? Another case I know of in Baltimore, where the whole family, and this was at the yeshiva actually, and the wife wanted to become a nurse, so they made an arrangement. He came home at 3 o'clock. From 3 until the end of the evening, the whole house was his. She went off to her nursing school, 3 years, 4 years, whatever it was, and he took complete control of the house from 3 p.m. on. So men do contribute, but the responsibility is hers. Now, if you say, but that means for a period of years, she's bearing a double responsibility, how could you do that? Isn't that inherently cruel and discriminatory and victimizing? I would ask you to consider another model. How about medical school? What happens to young couples where the husband or the wife nowadays is a medical student? 4 years, the medical student is not going to earn a nickel. 4 years of college, 4 years of medical school, 2 years of internship where you earn a nickel. And sometimes they have 36-hour shifts or 48-hour shifts. So isn't that cruel, victimizing, terrible? Except for one thing, that when the guy becomes a doctor, then they're going to earn $250,000 a year. And if it happens to be the husband who's studying to be a doctor, the wife says, it's worth it. It's worth it. Well, here you have a whole community of people, and it doesn't take 8 or 10 years usually, a whole community of people who feel that investing in the husband's Talmud Torah, Torah study, is worth it. It's worth it for the family, it's worth it for the community, it's worth it to make an investment in that, to live on a very low economic level, and to keep it going as long as you can keep it going. Some people keep it going for decades. There are those very...
Doesn't the Rambam write that it's not the Torah way? If you're always who writes that... You're supposed to make your own living. You shouldn't use Torah as an excuse not to work.
Actually, that's not true.
He writes it clearly.
No, no. You're quoting, you're adding to what he said. What he says is you shouldn't take tzedakah. Does not say you should make your own living. Those are not equivalent. The proof of it is the Rambam himself. He was supported by his brother, who was a gem merchant. He was supported for decades by his brother until his brother drowned in the Indian Ocean. So he didn't violate his own rule. He didn't violate his own rule. Yes. He was supported by his brother, and he practiced as a doctor only afterwards. What he says is you should not take tzedakah. You shouldn't take public charity funds.
No, tzedakah, what do you call tzedakah?
Public charity funds.
Yeah, I mean, he's supporting college, that's tzedakah?
Well, if his brother was supporting him for... for
public funds, that's correct.
Good, okay, fine, that's what I said. So it doesn't mean you have to earn your own living. You don't have to earn your own living, you just don't take public tzedakah funds, right? Exactly. Number one, but you should know that everybody disagrees with the Rambam. Everybody disagrees with the Kesef Mishnah on the spot, and it's passing the Zohar in the Shulchan Aruch, and all the other Rishonim disagree with the Rambam. So citing the Rambam here is citing a minority of one. Everyone else holds that there aren't public charity monies that are used to support Torah study, it'll disappear. So citing the Rambam here is citing a minority of one, and is not the position of the Halacha.
There's a difference. Public funds to support Torah study is different than making this a way of life, which means you support Torah for a certain segment of the community, which means people are the proper people to do that. Doesn't mean that this is the way of life for everybody.
I want you to show me a source for that. I have challenged many people for this. Show me a source that says that if the community has the funds to do it, that the Talmud Torah should be cut off at a certain educational level, or a certain level of intellect and creativity, and for other people, even if the money is there, they should not be encouraged to spend their lives in Talmud Torah. I want you to find me a source for this. I have not found any source for this in our literature.
Well, logic would tell you that if you're not cut out to learn, and you're not cut out to learn 8 hours or 10 hours a day...
But this is a different matter now.
Charity money, you're misusing the charity money.
There are two points to be made here. First of all, this is not the same as the point you made before. If you're talking about a person who's going to be spiritually injured by studying, then we could probably agree on it, even though I'll put a caveat on that as well. But that's not what you said before. What you said before is it's got to be only for an elite. And that's certainly not true, number one. And number two, even a person who's not cut out to study, and therefore, when you put him in a study position and you sort of create a social value that he should expect to stay in a social in a study position, and that will injure him, you have to ask the question whether he's doing something else won't injure him more. You have to compare possible injuries. Now, I know that I'm making a case now for the group that I don't identify with. Because we, the Hasidim sent...
Hasidim work, definitely.
Hasidim, that's right. Hasidim sent people out to work.
Hasidim, and some... Oberland that never heard, 100 years ago, you've never heard that. Actually,
okay, yeah. Okay. But there is another group, and their attitude will be, number one, you cannot find, I challenge you, find me a source that says that if you're not up to this level of scholarship, you shouldn't spend your life learning. I don't know anyone who says that.
Well, it's just a question of logic. Is if you are using the stock of money being used to its optimal level? That's the question.
So the answer is this, Hari. We say Talmud Torah Keneged Kulam, and we say it every morning, and we say it with great fervor. And when the Mashgiach in the Yeshiva gives us a shmooze and he says how important Talmud Torah is, he never says it's only important for the bright ones.
No. The point I'm making is the amount of time spent. When you come up to Olam Haba, they don't ask you, have you learned the whole day? They ask you, Kabbalat Yitzhak Torah, right? That is Talmud Torah. Learning set times that you set aside for learning. Not learning all day long.
No, that they ask everybody, but they don't ask that of a person who was able to learn Hari Bittul Torah. Bittul Torah, not...
Working is not Bittul Torah.
Sure it is, if you don't need to work.
If you don't need to work, but only take stock of money, is that this needing to work or not?
So I'm telling you, look into the Rishonim and you'll see that everyone is against the Rambam. Everyone. Yeah. There's a gigantic Kesef Mishnah right there in the Mishnah Torah, and he brings down all the parts.
I'm thinking more of, like someone says, all right, 10 hours a day is too much for me. However, 2 hours a day, I can handle. So I'm consistent 2 instead of 10 because...
Look, there's no question that not everybody is able to spend the whole day learning. There's no question. Although, you won't know until you try. You shouldn't write yourself off at the outset. Some say that if you don't see success after 5 years of learning, then it's a good sign that you're not going to be able to. Listen, we had a boy here when I first came. Nice boy. He was already from. Told me, Rabbi, I want to go to heaven. And there's a book. There's a book that tells you how to get to heaven. This book is the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, the abbreviated book of Jewish law. That tells you what to do. And if you do all those things, you go to heaven. So that's all I want to learn. I don't want to learn anything else. So just go through that, cover to cover, and I'll, learn it, and then I'll go to heaven. That's, what else is there to do? I said to him, you really have to spend some time on Gemara. He said, Rabbi, Gemara is so boring, And who cares if an ox gores a pregnant cow, and later you find the fetus on the ground, who would there beforehand to say, I don't have any oxen, I don't have any cows, I don't deal in fetuses. And I said, who needs this? I'm going to have a store, and I spent all my time learning Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, and that's how I'll spend my life. So I said to him, listen, that's not our Masorah, that's not our tradition. I begged him, do me a favor. Sit in the shir a couple of hours a day. Don't spend the rest of the time in the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch. I don't mind. Sit in the shir. Every month he used to come to me and say, Rabbi, I can't stand this. It's driving me crazy. It's a waste of time. What's the matter with this? And every month I would say, just try it some more. It'll, After about 10 or 11 months, I noticed he stopped coming back. Well, that could mean one of two things. He finally got fed up with me and just isn't talking to me anymore. So I let a couple of months go by, and then I approached him. I said, I'll see you in a couple of months. He said, yeah, well, the truth is, it's a little interesting now. That was it.
Tomorrow.
Yeah, it took him a year. It took him a year to get into his mind what was going on there. Now, I have others who never made it. I had one boy who was here for a couple of years, and he said to me, Rabbi, I feel so terrible that I wasted my college education. Because for the first time in his life, he began to realize what an education could be. And he spent 4 years in college playing around. And he now regretted it. That's why we tell some parents, a boy wants to spend another year in yeshiva and he hasn't gone to college yet and they're anxious to get into college. We say to them, from their point of view, this is an investment in his college career. Because he'll come out of here with a better ability to study, a greater appreciation of what study is, more focused as a person, he'll know what he wants. I taught college for 10 years. The biggest tragedy was kids who had no idea what they were doing there. They didn't know what they were there for. They didn't know what they were trying to get out of it. So they drifted from one thing to the next, and they were distracted most of the time, and didn't get out of it. They didn't achieve what it's worth. So the appreciation of study is something which you know, which you can learn in yeshiva as well. At any rate, the bottom line is, yes, not everybody's cut out for it, but and if you aren't cut out for it, then you find a way to live where you don't spend the whole of your time learning Torah. But this gentleman quoted a Gemara, which is very hard to live up to. Okay, so you're working, and you're doing other things, and you're learning Torah. Kavata itim the Torah, they're going to ask you. Did you set fixed times for Torah study? You know what that means? It means 6:30. I don't care if the biggest contractor's on the telephone. I don't care if the guy came in from out of town for a meeting. I learn at 6:30. No matter what. That's kavata itim the Torah. Nothing breaks this time. That's a very, very high level to achieve. Nothing takes precedent except somebody dying, God forbid. That's a very high level to achieve. Actually, it says a little more. It says, Osen Torah Sokva, Malach Torah. His Torah study is his focus. It is his usually the major part of his day, the most important part of his day. As Rav Dessler says, what happens to a person when he's in the middle of a business negotiation? Does his mind drift off to the Tosfos? Oh, but what did that Tosfos mean? Oh, I'm sorry, yeah. Well, are we talking about $10,000? I just lost the drift. Or when he's davening in shul, standing before the Kisei HaKavod, the throne of glory, and he's talking to Akash Baruch, does his mind drift off? Was it $10,000 or $20,000? Which way does it drift? So if it drifts only in davening to business, and while he's in business, doesn't drift to the Tosfos, it shows you where his emphasis is. It shows you where his focus is. His focus is on business. And the rest of it is when he had no time for business. That's not it. That's not kavata itim the Torah. That's not also malach the Torah sokva. That's the goal for the other person. This is the person not learning all day. Sorry? Yeah, but I'm quoting another Gemara. The Rambam, when he talks about Keset Torah, that's how he defines it. Because also Malach
the
Torah.
Means the going rate was to work.
So I tell you what the Marsha says. There's a famous theorem that Tosfos brings up. There are two places in the Gemara where it says what they'll ask you after 120, and they ask you different lists. One is whether you're koveit in the Torah, and the other was nasat. So he says it depends upon the person. Marsha says, explains Tosfos Torah. He says, you ask me, I'll tell you a different terrace. If the person's a Rosh Yeshiva, we'll ask him about Torah first. And if a person's working, then we'll ask him about work first. It depends upon what kind of person it is. Yeah?
What about a person whose main focus isn't study, but he has a specific time period when he does study? And then let's say he was in college, and you know, he had a certain time when he studied, and then he had a certain time when he went to college. And then when he finished his degree and he went into the work field, he changed the time at work and when he studied. He kept the same time. But he kept the same amount of time to study, but he changed the time when he did.
Yeah, I think that's no problem. You have to have a set time, but that should be the set time for the rest of your life. I don't think it has to be. By the way, this is the last thing I'm going to be able to say today, but this is very important. When you go to college, going to college is like being hired in a job. You owe a good college performance. You owe it. And you have to do it. A person should not say, my primary interest is Torah, and I'll do college half effort, and I will not give the time and emphasis that it deserves. He cannot say that because he's being paid to go to college. What do I mean he's being paid to go to college? Who's paying him? His parents, first of all. And not only your parents. What you pay to go to college is one-third of the cost. Two-thirds of the cost is charity. Everyone who goes to college is taking charity. I love these people who are so self-righteous and so self... they feel that they're earning their own way. The president of the university is a schnorrer. He's a schnorrer. And he goes around the world raising millions and millions of dollars every year, so that two-thirds of the cost is not borne by the students. So somebody is paying money that you should get educated. For you to go there and for you to treat it as not important is just like being hired for a job and not doing the work that you are hired to do. You owe it to do a good job. Yes, of course, that doesn't have to be 18 hours a day. people who pay you for a job don't expect you to work 18 hours a day either. But you have to do a good job. And later, you won't berate yourself. I wasted the time. And because I wasted the time, I am in the position that I am in life, and I should have been in a better position. And the answer is you probably should have been in a better position because you didn't give it a real effort, the effort that it deserves. Yeah.
It's that Gemara that says you've got to set aside time to study does that apply to women as well because of their obligations with the people to study?
No. No.
Women don't have a chesed Torah.
Yes, they do.
Women? They have to know the halacha. There's no bittul Torah.
That's another question. Chiyuv is one thing, and bittul is another thing. Hari, they make the same birchas Torah the morning that men do. Asher kiddushanu b'mitzvah b'tzivanu lasok b'divrei Torah. They say those words, and it means that they may have a mitzvah lasok b'divrei Torah. But it isn't the same. It isn't the same level of chiyuv. And that particular part of it doesn't apply to them. That's true.
So how do they fulfill their obligation?
The way anybody studies anything, any subject. You know, a doctor becomes a doctor studying, but he doesn't have fixed times when he has to study. He studies when it's convenient.
Suppose women know what they need to know, they don't have to know more.
Well, a woman can conduct business, as we said before, right? So one thing she would need to know is Hilchos Ribis. You could spend the rest of your life on Hilchos Ribis. You'll never know all that you need. Hilchos Shabbos, Kashrus, Lashon Hara, you know very well. You could spend the rest of your life on that and not know it all.